Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
So I remember when Shogun was coming out and all the critics were calling it the next Game of Thrones. And what I remember is people had doubts about that. Well, those doubts are no longer. You know, Shogun, the finale just aired. Today on the show, we're going to talk about how Shogun became one of the biggest shows of the year. I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. You know, the energy we have today is that morning after a big season finale energy on today's podcast. So let's get right into it with this.
War is coming.
Life and death are the same. Both can have value and purpose.
I just hear that and I want to go to battle. I don't know if that's like a reaction that everybody else also has. That is a little bit of the trailer for Shogun. That's the FX TV series. It's an adaptation of James Clavell's novel from 1975. And we've had a bunch of weeks of earthquakes and seppukus and bloody beheadings. And then the series finale finally dropped last night. TV critics Kaya Shunyata and Ingo Kang are here with me today. We're going to talk about how the show became the prestige TV event of the year so far. But just to give you a heads up, this conversation is going to include some spoilers. So if you've not watched last night's finale, this would be a moment to maybe plug your ears. First of all, let's just get going. Let's just get right into this. And Kaya and Ingo, welcome to the show. I'm so happy that you're here. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. This is going to be a fun time. Okay, so I'm going to just set things up for our listeners real quick. Shogun is set in Japan in the early 1600s. It tells the story of the warlord Torinaga. He's battling his rivals for control of the country with the help of the seafaring British interloper, who you're like, why are you still on my screen? His name is John Blackthorne. And then the woman who sort of mediates between the two of them, her name is Mariko, who is both Blackthorne's translator and also the love interest. Kaya, last week, the penultimate episode ended on a bit of a shocking note, Mariko sacrificing herself to save Blackthorne from a gang of ninjas. How does that event take us into the finale of this week?
I think immediately in the finale, you can feel the loss of her presence, especially considering Mariko, in my opinion, is the best character in the show. And there's a shot that mirrors a shot from earlier in the season, where earlier in the season it was Mariko, Blackthorne, and Fuji. And this time it's just Fuji and Blackthorne. And it's an evident loss, not only in the show, but for viewers watching as well, because I think she is the fan favorite. I think that's safe to say.
And I think you really get a sense at that point of like what the human stakes of this war is, because for most of the show, you just have all of these rulers who are saying, I want to be leader. No, I want to be leader. No, like maybe we like the two of us should be leaders. And now that someone has actually died that they care about, things are real for them.
Yeah, there's the shock of that last week's episode. The way this sort of you know went through my social media feeds was quite significant. It was one of the loudest moments I've seen of the show on social media. Kai, let me ask you, what do you think of the finale overall? Did it bring a satisfying conclusion to this arc for you?
I think it did for me personally. Okay. I know some people felt like there wasn't enough fanfare, but I think that makes sense for this show. We can compare it to Game of Thrones all day, but this isn't Game of Thrones. There aren't dragons and White Walkers. This is a show really about humanity and the characters on the screen. So I think kind of making the finale essentially more toned down than the penultimate episode was a really good choice. And I think it made the impact stronger on me, at least.
Ingo, I want to ask you about the finale in just a moment. But we should say, like, since they debuted, Shogun has received all these rave reviews. Your review in The New Yorker was a bit more critical than most, I would say. Like, so tell me what you liked about the show, but also what you felt didn't quite work.
I felt it was a really great, you know, sort of reiteration of that Game of Thrones format. Hmm. There is one throne. There are a bunch of people who want to be on that throne. Who is going to be on that throne? What are the pros and cons of each person being on said throne? Yeah. I think, you know, it's a show that is not very big. It is an ensemble show, but I felt like at the same time, it just, it didn't really feel like all of the characters were fully developed. I think one of the four main characters is Toranaga. And because you have this like really big twist at the end that they are preparing you for, we don't really know very much about him until, you know, like the last 20 minutes of the finale, when he sort of like does this like James Bond villain confession and like sort of reveals everything.
Yeah.
And I know that Mariko is a fan favorite. She was very much written to be the fan favorite. And I understand why people consider her, you know, sort of like the beating heart of the show. And yet at the same time, I just could not figure out a way into relating to this character. Mm. Like, this is a woman who I think is so, you know, by necessity, she is somebody who is a product of her time. But if I, as a person in the 21st century, am supposed to relate to a woman who wants to die, but she feels like she needs her father's permission and also her boss's permission. Hmm. And also she's a mom, but she doesn't actually care about her relationship with her son enough to, I don't know, stay alive. And then also at the same time, she's just constantly giving you exposition because, you know, yeah, she's explaining the world of the show. Like, okay, I'm glad she got to sort of reclaim her dad and do exactly what she wants to do on Earth before she dies. And I know it's supposed to be a glorious death, but, you know, after that shock wore off, I just didn't really feel anything because I didn't care about her. And I certainly did not care about her relationship with Blackthorn.
So I want to come back to this because what you've done just now, Ingu, is established an away team. You know, Kai is the home team and you're the away team. There's a disagreement here over Mariko as a character. I want to come back to that in just a moment. But maybe, Ingu, let me ask you about the finale, the idea of like building up to this finale and then that shock of the penultimate episode. And then you get that finale. Did the finale work for you as a way to sort of wrap up this thing?
Yeah, I think we got really satisfying closures for many of the characters. Anjin sort of starts off the show landing in that tiny fishing village and immediately calls them barbarians or savages or whatever. And then at the same time, sorry, by the finale, by the end of the first season, he has so actually like gotten to identify on some level.
Yeah.
With the Japanese populace, that he's willing to sacrifice his own life for their well-being. I think Toranaga, you really find out who he has been all along inside. And my favorite character, Yabushige, meets, I believe, the only fate he really can, which is a semi-noble death, and yeah, also a death that is very both like grotesque and also funny and also sad, which yeah, I believe sums up that character perfectly.
All right, Kai, let's get back to Mariko for a moment because you said it's your favorite character. You're sort of watching the show. You pick out this particular character as the most compelling character to you. What about her makes her so compelling for you?
Maybe it's because I'm still like trying to heal from the sting of the final season of Game of Thrones and how the women were treated in that show.
Yes.
But I think it's really interesting to watch a character like this who is the main female character, and she's not this badass warrior type of character. She uses language, I guess, to kind of carve out a place for herself in this world. And I don't think, I guess, TV epics are used to that at the moment.
Right.
Thinking about like Game of Thrones, we have like the Daenerys's and the Arya's. Whereas I feel like Mariko is kind of the complete opposite of that in a way. I think you could argue that she could be girl bossified. but to me, I just think she's so much more interesting than most of the men on screen. And I mean, the actress is phenomenal and we need to start that Emmy campaign. But yeah,
let's go. Emmy campaign starting now. I'm ready. I'm ready. And listen, you brought up language. I'm glad that you did, because the dialogue in Shogun is like 70% Japanese, 30% English. And that doesn't just enhance the show's cultural authenticity, but also like the narrative tension. Let's listen to this.
He asks what you seek here.
To vanquish our common enemies.
So that's one of many, many scenes in Shogun where Mariko is serving as an interpreter between Toranaga and John Blackthorn. But as you kind of, this is a radio medium, but, you know, if you were watching this, you would see that, like, her translations, her interpretations are not 100% exact every single time. There's sometimes, like, a bit of shifts to the way that she sort of translates. Let's talk about the significance of Mariko's character and her interpretation of this story. Kaya, what do you make of this? What do you make of, like, the way that she uses language as a character?
I think especially with the relationship between her and Blackthorn, which is a little lackluster sometimes. Sometimes I was into it. Sometimes I was like, I don't necessarily care about you two together. but the only reason they kind of have this relationship is because she is his translator.
Sure.
So the relationship from the beginning is very understated. Because they've only really learned how to speak to one another without really speaking or speaking through other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really interesting way to kind of go with a romance like this. And especially thinking about language, like in the miniseries version from 1980, there weren't subtitles put on, so the viewer was kind of shrouded in darkness like Blackthorn,
right,
which I think would make an audience like that connect to him more, because you're almost as lost in this world as he is at the beginning.
Right.
Whereas here, we have access to subtitles, so we can understand not only what these characters are saying, but their motivations. And I think the way Mariko uses language is very interesting, because she's like a point A to point B character. She needs to get her task done for the day and go from point A to point B. And the way she kind of like sheds away at what she doesn't feel is valuable in regards to what people are saying or what she's translating, I think is really interesting when you're thinking about how her character is kind of just, I'm going to do it my way and we're going to do it like this, or it's not going to happen.
Ingo, let's maybe widen the aperture and just talk about the way that the Shogun in general used language. I think there's a lot to say about that. What did you make of the way that Shogun used and fused language into the show?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is sort of about a world that is sort of ending and there is a new world to be born, right? So much of prestige shows, so many prestige shows are about that. The Sopranos is a really perfect example. You know, like all of those gangsters feel like their time of, like the idea of like gangsterhood that they had in their head just like doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And I think this is a world in which all of these Japanese characters are caught in the samurai code of conduct, or, you know, this like pre-samurai code of conduct. And yet they are all really like befuddled by it. They are tortured by it. And in many cases, they have to die because of it. And so you were sort of like waiting for this like new era to come. And people, and only one character, Toranaga, really has like the vision to make this new era come. And I think what is really interesting about the use of language is there's so much there about what is actually being conveyed versus what has to be repressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a lot of questions in every conversation with a translator, almost, where someone says, like, is this person a reliable translator? Because Japan is shifting under their feet. Mm-hmm. All of these Portuguese people are coming in. This outside influence is coming in. And I think a lot of the Japanese elites have the sense that the priests are keeping things from them, but they don't know what that is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so because there is all of this opacity, they have to try to figure out who they can trust. And then also, you know, on a maybe like more interpersonal level, there are all of these things where what you think is not necessarily what you say. And sometimes you can sort of say dialogue in your original language and then say, don't translate that, or like, don't translate that
part.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I got maybe like a minute left, and I'll put this to you, Ingu, but like it's an interesting, there's another, as Shogun is ending, The Sympathizer is coming out. I saw that you also did a review of The Sympathizer, which is another show that features a lot of subtitles along with Vietnamese dialogue. What do you think about, what do you make of the fact that we're seeing more shows that are willing to sort of experiment with language and actually make the majority of the show not in English?
I love that we're willing to trust the audience to yeah. go there along with the show. And I love that, you know, inherent to this is a sort of cross-cultural dynamic that is being explored. I think maybe in The Sympathizer, even more somehow than this, it feels like it's yeah. sort of about like a tension between these various cultures mm-hmm. and sort of how do you become yourself in one language and then also like translate yourself to that other language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that it is really opening up new themes for what Pollywood can make stories out of. And at the same time, I love that it's allowing people to go beyond Hollywood. Like my favorite actors of Shogun are actually the Japanese actors,
yeah.
the actors who play Yabushige and Toranaga. And I love the fact that those actors were able to speak in their own original language. So, you know, they didn't have to like wrestle with like learning all of the dialogue syllabically or whatever, which 100%. We have seen a lot in a lot of Hollywood productions. And so, yeah, I only see an opening up, and I think it's great.
An opening up is a good place to leave it. Ingu and Kaya, thank you so much for your time. You guys are the best. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so
for
much. Having us.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Kaya Shinyata is a writer in Toronto. You can read the review of Shogun at Paste and RogerEbert.com. And you can read Ingo Kahn's take on Shogun in The New Yorker. Shogun, by the way, is streaming now on Disney Plus in Canada.
Hey, I'm journalist Sam Sanders.
I'm poet Saeed Jones.
And I'm producer Zach Stafford. And we are the hosts of a podcast called Vibe Check.
On Vibe Check, we talk about everything. News, culture, and entertainment. And how it all feels.
That's right. We talk about any and everything on our show, from real life issues like grief to music and movie critiques. And that barely scratches the surface.
Yes, indeed. And it doesn't stop there. We have got a lot to say. So join our group chat, come to life. Follow and listen to Vibe Check wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Okay, listen, not everything needs to be updated, but I am interested in this update, okay? The board game Scrabble has a new version. It's called Scrabble Together, and in this new version, no one loses. I'm having trouble with this. Players work together to solve a bunch of predetermined challenges. The change was reportedly inspired by a bunch of data that found that some Gen Zers might prefer a non-competitive version of Scrabble. As you can imagine, the backlash was swift.
Scrabble is dumbing itself down for the woke. The board game is getting updated to be more inclusive and less competitive. So is this more about wokeism, this new Scrabble, or is it about ADHD and the fact that they need friends and they need hints and they can't spell?
Okay, that's, but to be clear, not the reasons why I'm having trouble with the new Scrabble, but that is Fox News host Janine Pirro. Dan Coyce has played this new version of Scrabble. Dan is here to talk about it. Dan, welcome to Commotion, pal.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good, man.
I'm glad that you're here. Listen, what was your first reaction when you heard, you know what, there is a new version of Scrabble?
I was kind of psyched, okay. Honestly, because wife is so much better than me at Scrabble. That I have had to stop playing with her. She plays on her phone a lot.
Yeah.
So she now knows all the two-letter words. So she's like he and zying me off the table.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready with those two, man. I got those in the back pocket. I get it. Yes.
No, thanks. But so, you know, whatever. Call me a teenager, but I like the idea of a version where we could actually play and I would benefit from her skills instead of just being destroyed by them every time.
So you're saying you're like, oh, I actually don't mind not losing for once. That's what's in it for you this time.
Right. And the funny thing about Scrabble Together is that, you know, you introduced it as a kind of Scrabble where no one loses.
Yeah.
Which is not exactly right.
Okay.
It's a kind of Scrabble where everyone plays together and everyone wins or everyone loses.
That's all right. All right. That's a fair correction to the thing that I said. You've played this new version with your wife and your daughter, who is a Gen Zer. It sounds like it went all right for you. How did the rest of your family feel about it?
I think we all had a good time. So my daughter is 16. She's never played Scrabble.
Okay.
We play a lot of other games that has never made the rotation, perhaps because we're all afraid that my wife would destroy us all. But so the idea of Scrabble Together is that you are like given these tasks. You get these goal cards.
Yeah.
And they each have a task on them, like play a word containing a tile worth at least 6 points. And you are fulfilling the tasks. And you're also like setting up your fellow players to succeed when it's their turn. And once you get the hang of it, you're all working together to achieve this thing together. If you can achieve all the tasks before time runs out, you all win. Otherwise, you all lose. Now, it's not like that hard, honestly.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sure for Alia, for my wife, it was like a walk in the park. But it was really fun to actually be able to sit down with all three of us and make a bunch of fun words and like accomplish this thing together.
Okay, that you the way you described it sold it. I'm on board with this.
Look, it's like low stakes and low pressure, but it is also fun. Like
That's the thing is like I like the high pressure. I like when people put on the little timer and go like, "All right, you've got however long this timer is for you to come up with a word." That's to me that's the fun in Scrabble is just like watching intently and trying to mess other people up. But I get it. Not everyone shares my values. That's totally understandable. But I want to talk about this idea of Gen Zers not liking competition. Does that feel true to you? Like when you sort of think about the Gen Zers in your house, but also just in general, do you buy this notion that Gen Zers are less interested in competitive games?
Like any old person, I love being critical of younger generations.
Yes.
But I explained this theory of Scrabble Together to my daughter.
Yeah.
And she delivered like an eye roll for the ages, like a Daria level, like, eye roll.
Yeah.
Liking to cooperate and not being particularly competitive is not like a Gen Z trait. It is just a trait that some people have. Some people are like you and they really like to play Scrabble in a way that is designed to mess other people up and maximize their points, and they love the pressure. Other people are like not into that. When I think of what Gen Zers want in games, I think post-pandemic, they are looking for reasons to get together and have fun. You know, and God bless them. Someone needs to.
I'm glad that somebody out there is having fun. Look, we played that clip off the top of Fox News, you know, that's like Scrabble isn't even competitive anymore because of woke, you know, which is a silly conception, a silly way to frame this argument. What do you make of the divisiveness, though, that Scrabble Together has brought? Because you wouldn't think that the introduction of a cooperative game would get people up in arms and going like, oh, wokeness has now gone too far.
You know, I tried to play the word he on my Scrabble board and the board exploded and required that I use they, them pronouns. whatever. There's nothing more fun than getting angry because they're changing something that you're used to. But like, if you watch that whole Fox News thing, even the hosts could like barely take this seriously.
Okay.
There's not actually anything woke about a slightly different version of a popular game that they have made to try and sell more copies of the game to different people. And, you know, whatever. If you hate Scrabble Together, I have amazing news for you, which is that the original version of Scrabble is right on the other side of the board and you can still play that.
You don't have to play the woke version of Scrabble if you believe.
Right, no. Yeah, they haven't burned all the regular Scrabbles.
Good. I'm relieved that the regular Scrabbles are still intact. Okay, currently Scrabble Together is only available in Europe, which is outrageous. Do you see there being an appetite for Scrabble Together on this side of the continent?
Yeah, I think so. I never knew this until now, but it turns out that Mattel, who makes Scrabble Together, has a Scrabble license everywhere else in the world but North America.
Okay.
But in North America, it's made by someone else, Parker Brothers or someone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think there's a market here because honestly, some of the most popular board games out there right now, games like Pandemic and Gloomhaven and Spirit Island, which are like insanely popular, sell hundreds of thousands of copies, are not competitive games. They are cooperative games.
Yeah.
You cooperate with other players to battle a pandemic, to survive on this island that wants to kill you. You all win or lose together.
Yeah.
Scrabble Together fits right in that mode. And I think it's like a great entry-level way to get people interested in making words and working together to do this fun thing.
I got to say, I played Pandemic one time and we all lost together.
Yeah,
because
the
point is to prevent a pandemic and we did not do that. But then, you know what happened, Dan, is I was mad because I was like, well, I did my part. I tried my best to carry this team across and beat this pandemic. And did we beat the pandemic? No. And it was because
this bunch of losers caused everyone on Earth to die. And it sure wasn't my fault.
But here's what I came away from that. Here's the lesson that I took away from that that maybe is applicable to Scrabble Together. It's that I don't think I can cope well in a mode where, like, there is a team of – in the case of your family, for example, right? Like, your wife carrying the team is like, that's just me watching one person play Scrabble while I don't participate. And I get to go, like, I guess we all solved this one together, didn't we? Because, like, sometimes that's what ends up happening in those games is one person carries a team and the rest get to watch. Am I off base in this? Is that too cynical?
I would love to hear what the other people in your game of Pandemic thought your contribution was. Battling the pandemic.
Well, I'll tell you, I was doing
my
job.
Everyone thinks they're the Fred. Most of us are actually Scoobies, honestly.
That is a perfect place to leave it. Dan, this has been a delight. Thank you so much. I am no Scooby, but I'll take this and sit with it, I guess, if I must. I appreciate your time. Thanks for being here, man.
See you later.
You bet. Dan Coyce is a culture writer at Slate Magazine. He wrote about the public reaction to the new board game Scrabble Together. That game is currently only available in Europe. So, hey, if you're going to Europe, I don't know, can you grab me one? Because I want to try it, even though I'm not going to lie to you, I'll be the one carrying the team, and I don't want to do that. That is it for the show today. My name is Alamine Abdul Mahmoud. Hey, we are going to be back tomorrow. I can't wait to be back tomorrow. I will see you then. Thank you.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.